emerged in water. Garbhadaksh Rajasthan was alone, lying on his bedstead. The great snake Ananta, and lying on his bedstead, the great snake Ananta. And although he appeared to be in slumber in his own internal potency, free from the action of external energy, his eyes were not completely closed. Responsibly. At that time, when the three modes were submerged in water, Garbhadaksha Vishnu was alone, lying on his bedstead, the great snake Ananta, and although he appeared to be in slumber, in his own internal potency, free from the action of the external energy, his eyes were not completely closed. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Lord is eternally enjoying transcendental bliss in his internal potency, whereas the external potency is suspended during the time of the dissolution of the cosmic manifestation. Purport. Chapter 11. Santa Shari Re Vritta Bhuta Sukshmaha Kalatni Kam Shaktim Udi Rayanaha Pubasa Tasmin Salile Pade Sve Itana Lo Daruni Tiviriha. Just like the strength of fire, this is Prabhupada's translation, just like the strength of fire within fuel wood, the Lord remained within the water of dissolution, submerging all the living entities in their subtle bodies. He lay in the self-invigorated energy called Kala. Purport, Srila Prabhupada. After the three worlds, the upper, lower, and middle planetary systems, merged into the water of dissolution, the living entities of all the three worlds remained in their subtle bodies by dint of the energy called Kala. In this dissolution, the gross bodies become unmanifest, but the subtle bodies existed, just like the water of the material creation. Thus, the material energy was not completely wound up, as in the case of the full dissolution of the material world. I'll read one more. Chatri Yudana Sahasram Apsu Svapan Svayu Diratarya Svashakta Shaktya Kalakya Yasadi Takarma Tantro Lokam Apitan Dadishe Svadehe. The Lord lay down for 4,000 yuga cycles in his internal potency, and by his external energy, he appeared to be sleeping within the water. When the living entities were coming out for further development of their future activities, fruitive activities, activated by the energy called Kala Shakti, he saw the transcendental body as bluish. He saw his transcendental body as bluish. Purport. In the Vishnu Purana, Kala Shakti is mentioned as avidya. The symptom of the influence of the Kala Shakti is that one has to work in the material world for fruitive results. The fruitive workers are described in Bhagavad Gita as mutas, or foolish. Such foolish living entities are very enthusiastic to work for some temporary benefit within perpetual bondage. One thinks himself very clever throughout his life if he is able to leave behind him a great asset of wealth for his children. And to achieve this temporary benefit, he takes the risk of all sinful activities without knowledge that such activities will keep him perpetually bound by the shackles of material bondage. Due to this polluted mentality, and due to material sins, the aggregate combination of living entities appeared to be bluish. Such an impetus of activity for fruitive result is made possible by the dictation of the external energy of the Lord, Kala. There's a picture, it's a painting, of Vyas getting instruction in the Himalayas, and his body is bluish color. Someone said that they thought he was blue because it was so cold up there in the top of the Himalayas. I don't know if that's true. But somehow this blue is associated with the mode of ignorance and fruitive activity. Even though Krishna is blue, but that color sometimes is associated with ignorance. And it's partly because Krishna embodies the external energy as well as the internal energy. Of course, the sky is blue due to the effulgence of Krishna. Prabhupada has told us. Someone asked him once why the sky was blue. And that was his answer, which is very interesting. In a recent Back to Godhead, there's a description of the different forms of the Lord. I don't know if you get Back to Godhead here, but it's either the latest one or the one after the latest, or the one just before the latest one. I think it is the one just before. Oh, this is it, yeah. Names and forms of the absolute truth. It's very interesting, and there's a chart of the different manifestations of the Lord, including the Garbhagakshaya Vishnu, Pranagakshaya Vishnu, Shiragakshaya Vishnu, who are the Purusha avatars. And this is a chart. This is a very interesting fact to Godhead. This is the one before the latest one. And Prabhupada tells the story of how she wanted to understand not just that there was God, but if he created the universe, she wanted to know how it happened, or what were the different manifestations. So this is a very interesting chart, because it talks about the Svayamrupa manifestations, the Tadekatma Rupa, the Avesha, and it's very interestingly done and very nicely laid out. So I would recommend it if you get this magazine. Does it come here, or do you have to subscribe individually?
In this subscription.
Oh, okay. It's a very good magazine. We'll later on read one of the stories. It's in the library, huh? Okay. When Albert Einstein died, I happened to be wanting to see what the news media had to say about him. And one of the things they said was that he said, the last thing he's known to have said before he died, was that, "I want to know how God created the universe. I want to know how God created the universe. Everything else is detail." So here was a great learned person, immortalized, at least for the time being, for his great learning, scientific mind. And of all the different things that he learned, that he knew, that he was curious about, this is the thing he wanted to know. He had a great belief. This signifies that even people who are materially advanced may want to know about God. Not always, but sometimes they can. And he was considered to be so important, so valuable, that there was even talk of preserving his brain in some kind of brine or putting it in some kind of suspended animation so that it could be studied for future use. Imagine. I think Prabhupada even commented on that, how that's not possible. But that was actually, some scientists were actually thinking about doing that, to preserve the brain of Albert Einstein, to study it in the future, to understand how people could be so intelligent. Prabhupada also, understanding that the rational mind was the way the world works, or the way we think it works anyway, in the Western countries, deigned to put on the cover of the Bhagavatam, the first canto, there's pictures and a little legend on the inside flap cover of how the universe was created through these different Vishnus. People want to know, not just there's God and he said, "Let there be creation, there was creation, let there be light, there was light." They want to know what the different manifestations of the Lord are. This is what people want to know. They want to know how God comes to the earth, what are his different forms, are saintly people, are they manifestations of God? We know them as Shaktivesh avatars. Are they true manifestations? Are they full manifestations? Are they part manifestations? And then the question always comes into people's minds, God created the world, but who created God? So this is the rationalist mentality, they want to know. And of course, it's understood that there's a certain element that is, Swami Raj wrote about this in his book. He called it rational faith and irrational faith. There's a certain amount of faith that's actually required. And rational faith is the kind of faith that in his example, he talked about a golf course. We know that somebody built this golf course next door. It just didn't spontaneously spring into existence. Even though we didn't see the people, we haven't read even the accounts of who built it, but we trust that somebody designed it, somebody actually built it. They mowed the lawns, they created the greens, the fairways, and cut down all the trees and all that sort of thing. That's called rational faith. We have faith. So faith, then, isn't a bad thing. And if we use our logic to carry it to its logical extreme position, that we have to see, taste, feel, smell, measure everything, or it doesn't exist, that actually doesn't work. One of the things we learn in school is that everything that we know as matter is made up of atoms. And those atoms are made up of nuclei, and those nuclei are surrounded by things called electrons. Of course, now they've found all kinds of different so-called subatomic particles, in addition to electrons, like positrons and mesons and so on, and there's thousands and thousands of them. But what we learned was that the distance between the electron and the nucleus of an atom is a huge distance. It's much, much greater, thousands of times greater than the diameter of the nucleus. So that would mean that all matter that we see is mostly space. And that's the logical way that you have to think. So if you get hit over the head with a rock, it shouldn't hurt because it's all space. There's no such thing as anything solid. So if you just carry that out to its logical conclusion, it doesn't make any sense. But that's what we're trying to think. That's what everything is made up of. It's made up of atoms. So there are limitations in logic. And even when a teacher stands in front of the room and tells you 2 plus 2 equals 4, or the Revolutionary War took place in the 1770s between the United States and Britain, we just accept it. We don't look in the book. We're not able to talk to anyone who lived in 1770. But we just read all the history books and we presume it's true. We don't know. And guy could have made up the whole thing. Was there a Peloponnesian War? Well, we don't know. We just have one historian's account of it, basically. So there's always an element of faith that enters into it. And Prabhupada said that the Bhagavad Gita was the perfect combination of reasonability or rational thinking and emotional or sentimental understanding or faith. And so in this sense, the division between faith and reason isn't that it has to be one or the other. You either accept things on blind faith or you accept everything because it's reasonable. We were speaking about how when it was actually filmed that deities were absorbing water, apparently drinking water. There was one day when this happened. There was a society of people in Bengal, of all places, who said, oh, that's not true. It's impossible. This just defies the laws of physics. And these effigies, these representations, these little murtis or whatever the word they used, idols or icons, they're porous and they're absorbing all this, and it's just a trick. Even though it happened all over the world in hundreds of locations, the rationalist society had their belief that it was impossible, and that's a belief too. So that's another kind of belief that we might call irrational belief. It's just like someone that breaks a brick with their hand, and that's not physically, it defies the laws of physics. And they say, well, you know, maybe the guy was strong. There's always a reason why it could happen, but it's actually defiant. It shows that there's mind over matter. All these people that walk on hot coals, the rationalists will say, even though they're very ordinary people, well, they were just into some kind of a trance temporarily, and therefore they didn't get burned. But actually, that defies the laws of physics. You can't walk across hot coals and not get burned. So this proves out what the Bhagavad Gita tells us in Jnana Karana or in Vyayoga Paramaha, that the mind is actually higher than physical elements. That this piece of brick, which can't be broken by a bone with this density and this kind of flesh, can be broken because the mind is doing it. The mind is actually more powerful than the matter. So then we can go further than that, and we can say, well, how did Prahlad Maharaj get thrown into boiling oil and off of a cliff? How did he get attacked by people with sharp weapons, not get pierced, not get burned, not get his bones broken? So that's like another step, because he was meditating on Krishna. He was remembering Krishna at every second. And it's more than just the mind. I mean, some people say, well, it was just the mind. He had, you know, great mental power. He could not feel the water. I know, people do. They can get into sort of a trance-like state and get into hot water. I don't know about boiling oil, but I knew someone that did that. It was a very ordinary person. He hypnotized himself and got into hot, literally hot water. Because after a while, it burned him because he went out of his trance. Anyway, if we're able to remember Krishna every moment, I mean, really remember deeply, as Prahlad Maharaj did, then those great difficulties, the things he was put into, the pit of snakes and everything else, it wasn't effective. Which leads into the article that I wanted to read. And I'm going to, if you'll indulge me. There are, of course, 9 types of devotional service, and one of them is remembering. Prahlad Maharaj is glorified. He's a personification of smarnam, or remembrance. So this is one person's article on the concept of remembering Krishna, which I thought was very well written, very good, about how we can remember Krishna at every moment. Keeping our thoughts on Krishna, it's called. It's by Dwarkadish Devadasi. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, the devotee Prahlad, this is a little introduction. A great spiritual authority says, hearing and chanting about the transcendental holy name, forms, qualities, paraphernalia, and pastimes of Lord Krishna, remembering them, serving the lotus feet of the Lord, offering the Lord respects, offering prayers to the Lord, becoming a servant, considering the Lord one's best friend, and surrendering everything unto him, in other words, serving him with body, mind, and soul, these 9 processes are accepted as pure devotional service. One who has dedicated one's life to the service of Krishna through these 9 methods should be understood to be the most learned person, for such a one has acquired complete knowledge. Here we continue our series in the 9 processes. So this is the article. Let's show it. So I can read this one more. Stick a cane out and grab me by the neck and pull me off the grass this morning. There's nothing special about the girl to show that she might be religious. No veil, no long skirt, no crucifix dangling from a chain. In a mall, she would blend in easily with droopy jeans and clumpy shoes. And yet, as she lifts her hand to push back a strand of bleached hair, I see the bracelet around her wrist, a simple cord with beads spelling WWJD. Do people have that here? WWJD? Followed by a question mark. What would Jesus do? Yeah, that's a real popular thing now. Their pendants, their bracelets, their necklaces, they have that little inscription, WWJD. Right. What would Jesus do? In that movement, her religious faith is revealed. What would Jesus do? How many times a day does she glance at her wrist and pause in her activities? Now, sometimes this makes me think of how when devotees get together and then try to think of what should be the right course of action, what should we do now? Sometimes it gets down to saying, well, what would Prabhupada say if he were here? And what would he do if he were physically here, you know, personally present with us? Which makes us think how great Prabhupada really was. Like the manifestation of Jesus changed the whole world, literally changed the world, changed the way that the so-called cradle of civilization was run, how it just transformed it at some point. After a few hundred years, it became the Roman Empire, became the Holy Roman Empire. And then today, it's just on everybody's mind. So we think that Prabhupada will attain that kind of status after a time, that will change the world in a similar way. So what would Jesus do? How many times a day does she glance at her wrist and pause in her activities? How often does the bracelet remind her to be compassionate, tolerant, strong in her beliefs? By continually refocusing herself in this way, the girl is practicing one of the items of devotional service remembrance, called smaran in Sanskrit. It is the third of the nine items of devotional service. On the most basic level, remembrance may be the easiest way to worship the Lord. No need for elaborate rituals and paraphernalia. No need for a congregation or even a companion. Remembrance can be a simple, unadorned journey of the heart back to the most beloved friend we all have. Or it might be a flash of warning, an awareness that our actions will pain our Lord in some way. Or it can be the bittersweetest realization, the bittersweet realization that all in this world is temporary, and that is the mercy of God. In countless ways we can remember. Implicit in the concept of remembrance is forgetfulness. If remembering means coming back to our personal experience of God, then there must have been some departure. This departure, this forgetting, is the main attribute of living entities in this world and the cause of our pain. Forgetfulness may begin as neglect of spiritual practices, a wandering mind, a careless attitude. Then other things seem to rise in importance: wealth, prestige, family education. We compromise spiritual principles as our heart hardens and turns away from the comfort of natural servitude. And that was one of Rupa Goswami's statements, wasn't it? That the most elementary, the most fundamental of religious principles is yena tena prakarena mana krishna nideshaya sarva vidhi nishedasya etayo vakinkara, that above all the rituals and regulations is always remember Krishna and never forget him. Always remember Krishna, never forget him. We might reach a point where remembering God brings pain. A child may dress in the robes of a king and play at ruling others, but when the real king shows up, the fun is over. We may play at manipulating our world, at squeezing out pleasure for ourselves, and do our best to avoid contact with the real ruler. We come to believe that if we acknowledge the supremacy of the Lord, he will ruin our fun. Yet at times we may notice a stirring, a sense of some truth forgotten. We may despair that life seems hurried and empty. Forgetting God is so truly unnatural for the soul that it creates varying degrees of agony. And the more we have banished the Lord from our consciousness, the less able we are to find a remedy for the pain. A new car doesn't help. A new romance doesn't help. Exotic vacations don't help. The classic example is that of the bird living in a golden cage. The cage can be polished, shined, and admired, but if the bird within is not fed, it will die. The soul is encaged within the body and embellished with all the desires relating to the body. Polishing the body and its desires brings no nourishment to the soul. And while the soul itself does not die, it suffers terribly in separation from the Lord. We can help prevent such a situation by structuring our lives to provide us with constant reminders. Ritual and congregation play an important role. Prabhupada has written and said on many occasions that we should mold our life, those are the words he used, mold our life in such a way that we will never forget Krishna. In other words, the home should have gaze of Krishna, there should be incense always burning, we can play music of Krishna, we can have pictures of Krishna on the wall, we can entertain devotees for eating or anybody. We can create a kind of spiritual atmosphere everywhere we go. In that way, it's remembering. If we set up a ritual of offering all we eat to the Lord and offering prayers of gratitude before we eat, we are again reminded of Him. If we surround ourselves with like-minded people who share our compassion for serving Krishna, their energy and devotion replenish and inspire us. In the same way that athletes grow strong through training, our ability to remember God can strengthen through daily training. Eventually, remembrance becomes our normal condition. The state of constant remembrance is described in many religious traditions, and in Sanskrit it is called samadhi. Samadhi need not be passive, a physical withdrawal from the world, as one becomes immersed in thoughts of God. Rather, samadhi is the awakened realization that all in this world is but a reflection of Him. Everything belongs to Him and can be used to serve and praise Him. Srila Prabhupada compared remembrance to Krishna to a mother's feelings of love when she sees her small child, Shiva. A self-realized soul sees all things immediately connected with the Lord. The mother doesn't try to wear the shoe, and the self-realized soul doesn't try to exploit the world for temporal gain. For love and joy come only from the connection with the beloved. Srila Prabhupada points to Prahlad Maharaj as the one who perfected remembering the Lord. As a child, Prahlad showed pure trust amid extreme danger. His father, Hiranyakashipu, was exceedingly horrible. His terrifying austerities altered the balance of the universe. Brighton Devas, demigods, begged him to stop, which he did only when Lord Brahma offered him protections that would render him virtually immortal. With such power and determination, Hiranyakashipu became a tyrant who ruled the world. Everyone lived in fear of him. He reserved special wrath for Lord Vishnu, who had killed his brother. Enter son Prahlad. Prahlad had developed devotion to Lord Vishnu while still in his mother's womb. Despite the efforts of his teachers to crush his devotion and interest him in his father's vulgar politics, Prahlad continually sang praises of the Lord. It was Prahlad who, at the age of 5, described the 9 processes of devotional service. Eventually, Prahlad's devotion infected his schoolmates and landed him in big trouble with his father. Now, an ordinary dad, with a capital D, might withhold supper or send his son to his room, but Hiranyakashipu was given to extreme behavior. He tried to kill Prahlad. He had his servants pierce Prahlad's body with tridents, poison his food, boil him in oil, and hurl him under the feet of an elephant. Prahlad just sat silently and remembered the Lord, the powerful form of resistance, a powerful form of resistance. All attempts on his life failed. A true lover of God, Prahlad did not beseech the Lord to save him from his dangers. He simply remembered and appreciated the Lord's greatness and thus found complete peace. His love for Krishna was unconditional. To remember the Lord at death is a great fortune. In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, whoever at the end of this life puts his body remembering me alone attains my nature. Of this there is no doubt. The opportunity to meditate on the Lord at the end of life does not come to everyone. In commenting on this verse, Prabhupada cautions, remembrance of Krishna is not possible for the impure soul who has not practiced Krishna consciousness in devotional service. We can't predict what the last moments of our lives will be like. Death can be an extremely painful and difficult moment, and the likelihood of remembering Krishna at such a time depends on His grace and our practice. That was an article written by Dwarkadish Devadasi. And that's a whole series of articles. There's remembering and serving the feet, and we'll go on up to giving everything to the Lord. So, thank you very much. I think we should carry on. It's one of the members of this. Okay, so thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.